Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. How will our next president direct the way we harvest and use power here in Texas and across the U.S.? A USA Today poll finds Americans consider energy policy and pricing the most important issues of the 2008 election. So what ideas do Senators McCain and Obama bring to the table, and would they change the way Americans live? Joining us with some insight are Bruce Bullock, director of SMU's McGuire Energy Center, and Elizabeth Souter, who covers energy issues for the Dallas Morning News. Bruce, Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Hi.
What do you think Americans are listening for when John McCain and Barack Obama speak about energy?
I think our readers are upset about high gasoline prices and high electricity prices. I mean, that is... It's all about their bills that they see every month and what they're paying at the gas pump. So whether they have ideas of ways to cut these prices or quick fixes, I think these are all attractive to our readers, at least, or the ones that contact me. A lot of people, I think, also want to hear something more in-depth about how to fix the problem fundamentally rather than just do a quick fix. But quick fixes are popular, too, I think.
I would agree with Elizabeth. I think in many ways the American people now are further out in front of this issue than either of the two candidates. They're looking for specific solutions both in the short term and the long term. And I think they've seen past a lot of the rhetoric that both, populist rhetoric that both of these candidates have started out with and are pressing them more to provide us some real solutions for things that we really haven't discussed for 30 years.
Both of these men have offered a variety of different solutions, but it seems like, to generalize, that Barack Obama is more focused on reducing consumption and John McCain is more focused on increasing domestic production. Can you talk about some of the other ways that their approaches maybe differ, Bruce?
Well, I think that's that generalization tends to sum it up fairly well. I think Obama also is probably more focused on government-specific types of activities, whether it's funding or direct research, whereas McCain is focusing more on incentives and so forth. A couple of differences on both sides. You have Obama, who's calling for a windfall profits tax on oil companies. And then on the McCain side, he's called for this gas tax holiday. McCain has also really focused the last couple of weeks, especially on this offshore drilling issue, which has kind of caught fire on its own. But there are also a lot of similarities between the two of them. You've seen Obama kind of tack back towards the middle on some of these, and you've seen McCain's really describe his policies as kind of, well, all of the above. So there are some common grounds there, more on the goals than actually the specifics in terms of how they want to accomplish that.
So if everything works out, we'll end up in the same place regardless of which man is elected?
Well, there's one key difference that's kind of a detail, but that I noticed when I was looking at their energy policies this morning. McCain is very pro-nuclear power. He wants to build, I think, 45 more nuclear plants in the U.S. Obama is pro-nuclear, but he has some caveats. He wants to make sure that we have somewhere to store nuclear waste permanently. He doesn't like doing that in Yucca Mountain. He doesn't think that's a good solution. This is important for Texas because companies here have proposed, I believe, 6 nuclear power plants. We're going to need more power here in Texas. There's a proposal to put 2 more reactors
here in Texas.
Comanche Peak, mm-hmm. Which is nearby in North Texas. So this is a big issue for Texas, and it's something that the details can really matter for Texans and whether we have the power we need.
Of course, we've heard now that, I guess, Boone Pickens calls Texas the Saudi Arabia of wind. Are the candidates, do you think, listening to the Pickens plan?
I think I give credit to Pickens, whether it's through self-interest of his own or through his concern for the country's energy policy, for at least putting something out there with some specifics and some details. In other words, how we're going to do this. And until that happened, we really didn't see either of the two candidates really begin to go into any details in terms of how they were going to accomplish things. And wind is certainly going to be an important part of that going forward, whether it's here in Texas or anywhere in the middle one-third of the country. But I think it's raised the level of debate, if nothing else, in the campaign and on the issue in general.
I'm sorry, the candidates are suddenly talking about dependence on foreign oil, and nobody was talking about that before Pickens, or, you know, it wasn't really a part of the debate. So I think just inserting that language into the debate is interesting.
Both of the candidates at this point have full-time energy policy advisors, and both of those advisors have really strong bipartisan credentials. What does that tell you about what these men are expecting once either one of them is elected?
To me, I think a really important similarity is that both candidates want to cut our carbon emissions, and that has become a bipartisan issue, and that probably is why they wanted these bipartisan advisors. So no matter what happens, we're going to cut carbon emissions here in the U.S., and that has big implications for how much we pay for electricity and who gets to generate it and all these kinds of things. So the bipartisan side is important there, at least.
I think that's correct. In any campaign, you always have your policy advisors and your political advisors, and you tend to listen to both of them, and inevitably you end up going where the votes are. And I agree with what you just said. I think there are some bipartisan credentials that I hope in the end their arguments will prevail, as opposed to a lot of the political advisors, which seem to be continually putting more populist type solutions on the table.
Even if the approaches differ, I suppose it's nice to have an issue that both sides agree is a problem, which so seldom happens lately.
I think that's true. I mean, this is a problem that we've known we were going to have to address for 30 years, and never has the politics and the economics really lined up at the same time, and maybe for a chance, for the first time in a while, it will.
So you talked earlier, Bruce, about the fact that Obama is talking about actually putting money directly into research and technology and into transforming us from the kind of economy we have now, which is based on fossil fuels, to one that's more progressive. And then John McCain is focusing on a tax cut. I think it's 10% forever for companies that are working on research and development in the energy field. And then there's a big prize for an electric car battery. Can you talk, perhaps both of you, about the pros and cons of putting most of our faith in the private sector as opposed to putting a lot of money into public research?
I think in the energy issue in general, we're going to have two thrusts, if you will. One is a thrust for the next 20 or 30 years where, like it or not, we are going to be dependent upon hydrocarbons, whether it's natural gas, oil, or whatever. At the same time, we're going to have a longer-term thrust towards green energy, towards more electric vehicles and other technologies which just aren't quite there yet. And I think the government can play a very important role in that regard. For the most part, the private sector does application-type research, something that they can get to market fairly quickly. They don't do a lot of basic research anymore, and that's more of a government role. And in that respect, I think the government has a role, especially in the longer term. Shorter term, market mechanisms and others will do probably more to help in the immediate in terms of gas prices and finding oil and reducing our consumption.
The other difference is that Barack Obama is calling for doubling fuel efficiency standards within 18 years. John McCain says, let's stick with the ones we have now and fully enforce them. What do we know about the way the market drives demand for more fuel-efficient vehicles that may or may not reflect federal standards?
Well, it's incredible to me that in the past, 4 months, people have suddenly started really changing their lifestyles to deal with high gasoline prices. That was not the case last spring or even last year. People just weren't doing much. And it went from people sort of not driving quite as often or not driving out to the outlet malls quite as often, to people buying new vehicles that are more efficient. And I think that the high gas prices is driving that. I mean, you can do all kinds of fancy things with laws and policies, but when it comes to your commute from Frisco every day and, you know, doubling in price, that's a whole new issue.
Something that people feel very immediately.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about alternative energies like wind and solar. Neither candidate attended the latest vote that would have renewed tax breaks for new wind and solar construction, and in fact they didn't pass. Does that absence really belie a sort of lack of interest in new energy technologies that speaks louder, do you think, than campaign rhetoric?
Clearly, I think both candidates recognize the importance of wind and solar. This particular issue, I think, is more, and the lack of interest in actually renewing them is probably more election year politics and posturing on both sides than anything else. I think that if you look at the wind energy, and it could, in fact, if it were to be developed, it could account for up to 20% of the nation's electricity at some point, whether it's through Boone Pickens' plan or through some other plan, and a lot of utilities are already adopting them. All that being said, the tax credit has been a significant incentive to go forward with that. So I can't imagine another bipartisan energy bill coming up without those in there being renewed.
There's a big cost associated with boosting our wind energy output to 20%. We don't have the transmission lines that go from the wind centers to the population centers. Those have to be built. And especially here in Texas, our infrastructure can't yet handle that much wind. We just don't have the software programs to deal with wind and weather yet. And all of that costs billions of dollars. And that's something that, at least in Texas, consumers have to end up paying for. So I think there's another side to this. And there's also the issue of companies that are wedded to coal plants and nuclear plants. They don't want that much wind energy. It's cheap. It's going to drive down their prices. There are voices out there sort of trying to slow down this movement toward wind.
Well, wind has been described by proponents as a sort of one-time infrastructure investment. You lay down this
right.
initial capital and you're done. Does that sort of neglect the maintenance and the other costs that would be associated with maintaining those transmission lines and making sure that the wind turbines were in good shape?
I'm not sure that the maintenance is as expensive as the one-time cost. I think you're right about that. That it is it's more of a one-time issue than a longer-term cost.
That's very true. And Elizabeth's right in terms of existing companies that are out there. I mean, we have several companies in this state that are diametrically opposed to each other on the development of wind energy. And so at some point, the utility industry in general is going to have to come to some kind of alignment on this before it really goes forward mm-hmm. to the level that we're talking about here.
Do you think, with all the talk about alternative energy sources this election season, that the traditional energy interests have any less political influence than they've had in the past?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I think this the influence that is being felt the most this election is the average person that has to fill up his tank. And I think for a change, the average individual is the one that's really driving the debate on this, and not so much strictly the oil and gas companies or strictly the alternative energy companies or so forth. I think the point people on this debate is the guy that's got to fill up his tank every week, and it's gone from $50 to $80 over the last year.
The last time that we had a president ask us to really conserve energy in a major way, it was Jimmy Carter in the 70s, and people kind of snickered about putting on a sweater. Do you think the next president will actually have a much more receptive audience in the American people if he says, yes, you have to cut back how much energy you use and you have to make these changes in your life?
I don't see much willingness among regular people to conserve unless they save a lot of money. That seems to be what drives our readers, at least the people that contact me, to change their ways.
Absolutely. Markets do work. Sometimes they're painful.
As
but
we're
they
seeing
do
right
work.
Now.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much both for being here.
Thank you.
Just ahead on Think, the Art Institute of Chicago gets a makeover and the Kimball gets an unprecedented loan of Impressionist works. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seek calendar for this weekend includes an adult comedy, Splashes of Color, and Defying Convention. At Central Track, come out for the opening of Geomorph, Rethinking Landscape, a six-artist exhibit testing the boundaries of conventional landscape representation. Meanwhile, at the Cerulean Gallery in Snyder Plaza, it's all about color, and lots of it, in their brand new show, Vivid Imagination, featuring a variety of styles and media from five of the gallery's artists. At Teatro Dallas, don't miss My Favorite Animal, the latest adults-only comedy from award-winning playwright Tom Syme, gearing up for its New York run and co-produced by Joe and Sandy Black and The Modern Stage. And on stage in Fort Worth, three dreamers take you inside their respective nocturnal worlds in Dreams Do Not Care, a lyrical romp featuring music from Johnny Simons, presented under the stars at the Hip Pocket Theater. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
How does an expansion of the famed Art Institute of Chicago benefit North Texas? For one thing, the renovation requires that many of the museum's world-renowned Impressionist paintings move out for a time. And fortunately, the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth has just the place to display them. Malcolm Warner is acting director of the Kimball, where the Impressionist master paintings from the Art Institute of Chicago are on display now. Malcolm, welcome to Think.
I'm happy to be here.
So this is the largest group of paintings to move from the Art Institute en masse.
They occasionally lend their paintings to specific exhibition, but yes, this is the first time so many of their greatest treasures have been out of the Art Institute. We're lucky to get them.
So you folks at the Kimball heard that they were renovating and thought, we'll just give them a call and see if they
want
us to handle
it. That was exactly it, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. And they were happy to deal with us because they knew that the Kimball is such a fantastic place to see paintings. You know, we have this wonderful natural light. Impressionist paintings were painted in natural light, and they really sing out when they're there. So for the Art Institute, it's a treat, too, even though, you know, they don't have their greatest works on show at their own museum. At least they know that people are enjoying them in Fort Worth.
They're not going to waste.
Yeah, they're not going to waste.
How were the works chosen specifically for the show?
Well, we thought when we started that maybe they would try and skimp on some of the best things, you know, but they didn't. Absolutely, they gave us their greatest holdings in this particular area, the Impressionist movement, going into what's sometimes called post-Impressionism. So we have great works by Monet, Renoir, going into Van Gogh and Toulouse-Lautrec at the end of the 19th century. So that's where their strength is, and they gave us their best things.
And are they normally hung all together at the Art Institute in a similar way to how we'll see them at the Kimball?
They are, yes. Those are the most visited rooms in the Art Institute of Chicago, which, of course, is a gigantic museum. I mean, it's 100 times bigger than the Kimball. That's where the people tend to pack in, as they are now doing in our building.
What is it, do you think, Malcolm, about Impressionism? There are so many people who say they're not really that interested in art or they don't know much about it, but they will say the one style that they're drawn to is Impressionism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're the most loved artists in the world. And I think it's because they deal so directly with the here and now. You know, it was the here and now of 150 years ago, but it's not so very different from the here and now of today. They celebrated the pleasures of everyday things like, you know, nice light effects, the pleasures of sitting by the River Seine, having a meal in a restaurant, these everyday pleasures that are so easy to connect with, as opposed to, say, you know, the kind of more highfalutin, allegorical and narrative topics that older artists of this time were painting.
So they felt freed, really, as opposed to what the Academy said, to just do what they saw.
Yeah, it's a matter of technique, too. They paint in such a spontaneous way that their work seems so modern. What they were taught as students was to paint in a way that was perfectly crafted and finished to the nth degree. their revolution, in a way, was to paint directly, you know, so that each stroke they put down before the motif as they were painting their outdoors is what you see in the end. It's not all cooked up afterwards in the studio to make a kind of image of perfection.
Yeah, so I guess a lot of other paintings and the previous technique had been to layer very thin bits of paint, and Impressionism, the texture is very different.
Yes, you see the brush strokes, and it's part of the joy of their paintings is that you see how they've done it. You know, this wonderful way they use to describe things in nature through the direction and texture of brush strokes is just an amazing thing to witness. Later, with artists like Van Gogh, for example, the brushstroke becomes an expressive thing as well as a descriptive one. So they're describing what they see, but also injecting ideas and feelings through the way that they use the brushstrokes. You know, with Van Gogh, his famous brushwork, which tends to go in kind of the same direction, you know, those textures that create an almost a sense of an energy field that gives this tremendous emotional intensity to everything he painted.
Is Van Gogh really the line between Impressionism and Post-Impressionism?
Yeah, he picked, when he came to Paris from his native Holland, he picked up on what was happening in Impressionism at that time, and younger Impressionist painters were starting to regularize their brushstroke to make a kind of dotty or woven texture. They thought it harmonized the picture better than if you used different sorts of brushwork in different places. And he picked up on that, but took it much further in his own personal direction and turned it into this wonderful vehicle for expressing his feelings.
So as we have the opportunity, the rare opportunity, to see 92 of these masterworks in one place, how would you recommend that we approach these canvases? How close should we stand? How far back? Uh-huh. And how do we move our eyes around the paintings?
Oh, get as close as you can, I think. You know, our guards will stop you getting too close. but see them close up and far away. You know, as I mentioned, I mean, the part of the pleasure of them is this luscious paint that's there. It's almost, if you take any square inch of it, it's a gorgeous abstract painting, and then you stand back and there's a wonderful evocation of some beautiful light effect of you know, sunlight filtering through trees or something like that, that's captured with an almost uncanny truth to nature.
The Impressionists, of course, lived close to each other. They all knew each other. They influenced each other's works. Are there things in the show that are particularly good at reflecting how one artist's work led to another?
Yeah, I was very struck in this particular selection of works at the way that the work of Degas, you know, who painted these wonderful evocations of life behind the scenes at the ballet, but also, you know, a simple hat shop, millinery shop, how his work leads on so much to the great works of Toulouse-Lautrec. They have had a common interest in using bold compositional schemes, you know, with a sort of rushing perspective effects, and a liking for the slightly seedy side of life, or at least the kind of the working life of Paris, not so much the glamour. When Degas does the ballet scenes, they're behind the scenes, they're not the performance. Similarly, when Toulouse-Lautrec painted the Moulin Rouge in Montmartre, he loved the kind of slightly sleazy atmosphere that the place has, and that comes across very strongly in his works.
And I guess you've had a photo contest. It's turned out well?
Yeah, we had this idea that since Impressionist painting is about, you know, capturing modern life, that people today could try and do the same thing through photography, and it would be an interesting kind of exercise and a competition. That's gone very well. We've had some very high-level entrants into that competition.
Great to hear it.
Which you can see online on our microsite that's devoted to the show.
Excellent. Is that Kimball.org?
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much, Malcolm.
You're welcome.
You can see the Impressionist master paintings from the Art Institute of Chicago at the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth through November 2nd. For free video and audio podcasts, you can go to kera.org/think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.